We've traveled to sunny California to visit with a former Chicagoan, Willard Waterman, has asked us to come in, and we've asked him to talk a little bit about some of the good old radio days and his career. Hello.
Well, hello there, Chuck. It's a great pleasure to talk to you and sort of incidentally to some of your Chicago participants.
Well, thanks very much. You are. You came to Chicago, well, I guess it was in the middle 30s, wasn't
1935.
It? 1935.
Came from the University of Wisconsin. They asked me to leave because I didn't have time to attend classes. I was too busy in the theater and the radio station, WHA, which was the first educational radio station in the country, actually. And it's a very powerful one now, I understand.
Well, you then were just out of school as you started radio in Chicago in 35. Was your first job professionally in Chicago?
Well,
was it radio?
In radio in Chicago. I had done some professional work in Madison. I guess you'd call it insulting professional work. I made about 2.5 a program or something like that. But, I'd done a lot. I worked with a trio in Madison. We had a morning devotional service on WIBA when I was in high school, actually. And I do that from 7 to 7:30 in the morning and then go over to Central High and my high school classes.
So you were, as they say, bitten by the show business bug pretty early.
Fairly early, yes. As a matter of fact, I all through high school, and I prepped for an engineering course, architectural engineering, and planned to be in the engineering school at the University of Wisconsin. And the summer between graduating from high school and matriculating, I guess the word is, to the University of Wisconsin, I got interested in a company playing in Madison. We played the Drunkard for about 6 months in the hotel, and I got involved with other local dramatics, and finally decided by the time I went to university to change to the speech major, and speech and drama major, and I guess I've never looked back much. The engineering went down the drain, sort of.
Well, I think your contribution to the entertainment world is perhaps more than it might have been if you had contributed to the engineering world.
I hope so. I've tried to build a few bridges in the entertainment world, which I might have done as an architect. I don't know.
Well, that's a good way to put it. Now, what was your first radio job in Chicago?
My first radio job was in a show called Chandu the Magician on radio. And I auditioned. The show was just beginning to go on the air. And I auditioned for about 3 weeks for Chandu. And it got down to between myself and Howard Hoffman. And finally they cast a cast around me and one around him, and we televised. I guess I'm bitten by the bug. We wired to New York to the sponsors. Each did the show, and they chose his cast with him. So I was, of course, crushed. It was my first big opportunity, at least I thought so anyway. And I thought my life had ended, of course. But before the first show went on, there was a call from Blair Walliser, who was producing the show, to do a part on the first program. And I got to the studio and looked at the script, and here is this lawyer. And it's every line throughout the whole script. I thought, oh, boy, it's good. I'm going to have a part on this show. I turned to the last page, And the lawyer died at the hand of the Red Ghost of Rangoon. So that was that started a series. I think the first three or four, I guess I was noted for dying. The first three or four shows I got in Chicago were dying performances. An aviator who crashed, and there were four or five on Helen Trent, and I don't remember exactly the others, but I began to be known as being able to do a fine swan song.
That must have been pretty exciting, though, to be up for the lead in a series right out of the box.
It
more
was.
Or less,
it was terribly exciting. As I say, I was, when it didn't work, I was crushed. I have learned over the years that you don't let adversity bother you much, because if that one doesn't work, another one will.
You win some and you lose some.
You win some, you lose some. You play the law of averages in our business.
What role did you have in the beginning as a continuing role then, where you were an established character on a series, if that would be the case?
I did a lot of them on soap operas. Mm-hmm. In fact, I on Guiding Light, I did the... I was going to tell you his name. The lead, Betty Lou Gerson, and I did the two leads for a long spell on Guiding Light. And then, actually, after they moved Guiding Light to the coast here, we both happened to be out here, and they brought the characters back into the show. So we did Guiding Light for two or three years out here before it went off. Before it went to I guess went back to New York.
Now you played, I know, a role on the Tom Mix radio series out of Chicago.
I played a couple of roles. Longbow Billy was one, and I played Diamonds, who was the heavy. The an interesting thing, Hal Perry played a heavy on Mix called Hog Barrett. Mm-hmm. And I played this one called Diamonds. I was a 350-pound character, I ate chocolates, loved chocolate. Tom, pass me the chocolates up there. Tom, there ain't room in this town for both you and me. One of us has got to go. and I also played Longbow Billy, which is an old friend of Tom. That was one of the things in radio, which doesn't apply to television. You could play anything you could sound.
Anything you could sound
and,
like.
We all did many different characters on the same show a lot of times.
That was your value to the producer or the director, that you could double and
we were
triple sometimes,
more
I guess.
Hireable because they knew we could do a couple of different characters.
What other kinds of voice characterizations did you do?
I played a doctor on Road of Life who talked like this all the time, a very aspirate voice. I'm doing it very badly now, but I haven't done it in a long time. So you learn to do tricks with your voice.
Did you feel that by doing two or three voices in a show, that you were thinning down the pay that you were getting? Would they hire you to do three or four voices?
Well, in the beginning, that was true. And then when AFTRA, the forerunner of AFTRA, came in, there was a provision on doubling. You could do one voice. And if you did more than that, you got another fee. And that, of course, in later years changed so that you got a fee for whatever you did.
Everybody that I've spoken with about the radio days in Chicago has told me about the dash from the Merchandise Mart to the Tribune Tower to the Wrigley Building.
That's right. We all did that.
Bridges Up group.
Yeah, I once did. The Bridges Up, I belonged to that group out here when it was formed. We had lunch every Wednesday noon, quite often anyway. I had one, at one time I was on three networks within 45 minutes. Mm. I did a show on CBS called Bachelor Children, and it happened inadvertently. Somebody forgot, didn't see the name in the script, and so I wasn't called. And the last minute they called me and said, hey, you're in today. So there usually there was, that was on, I don't remember the day, time, 10:45 or something like that. And then the program on WGN Mutual was on from 10:45 to 11, 11 to 11:15, and then the one on NBC called Thunder in the Air was on from 11:15 to 11:30. So all of a sudden I turned in up in all three of them the same day, and I did the show on CBS, Bachelor Children, ran across the street to the Tribune Tower, and up in the elevator, which I had greased the man, and then I had a cab waiting for me down in the lower level, under the Tribune Tower, and I dashed down when the commercial came on, into the cab across Kinsey Street, which doesn't take the bridge into consideration. Mm-hmm. I have to worry about that. And in the one on Thunder in the Air, I was supposed to be in the first 3 or 4 minutes. Mm. And then another scene. So they reversed the two scenes.
Oh.
And I had about 3 minutes plus the commercials, and the commercials on the other end, to make the show. And I had an elevator waiting for me, and ran me up, and I went to the studio and picked up the script. And so I don't know how many other times that was done, but I was on three networks in 45 minutes.
You were probably, cabs were speeding in the other direction.
Doing the same.
Marvin thing. Miller coming the other direction, or somebody like that.
Yeah, we all did that, working in the soaps, because there were a lot of conflicts.
Now, you were freelancing at all of this time, is that right?
Well, I was under contract on Guiding Light, and most of it was freelance, though.
Mm-hmm. Most of the actors for radio at that period of time were, they could get whatever jobs they wanted. They were not on the NBC staff, for example.
Well, I was in the beginning. Uh-huh. Not the very beginning, but soon after I got to Chicago, I was signed to an NBC contract. Which actually didn't mean much. All it meant was that you were freelancing at NBC, because you had to be called by the NBC producers for whatever show they were doing, and you couldn't work across town. And so I won't go into it, but I finally got into a little contretemps with NBC, and I walked out on my contract, without notice, so I could freelance all over town. Mm-hmm. But actually, we were doing the same thing. And the people who were signed to NBC were freelancing, but only at NBC. That's all.
In the
contract had no salary involved. No, just whatever you did.
Were there other stations in Chicago doing original drama or?
Well, WGN was, but that was on Mutual Network.
Mutual. Uh-huh.
And there was WCFL was the blue network of NBC, and WMAQ was the red network, and of course WBBM was the CBS station, and we used to do some drama down on WIND. They had studios up in the top of the Palmer House. Actually, they were religious dramas of some kind. We did them every Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm. So you could easily work 7 days a week with all of this, wouldn't you?
I used to average 40 shows a week.
40 shows a week? 40. In other words, if you were on Guiding Light, that would be five. 5 shows.
And another 35. I worked mostly, erratically, of course, but from 7 o'clock in the morning until 10, 11 o'clock at night with the first nighter at Grand Hotel, Fifth Row Center, a lot of the evening shows.
You did a lot for First Nighter, didn't you? And you
did a lot of First Nighter.
You were not the main lead.
No, I was
Les Tremaine or Olin Soleil.
In the resident company, you'd call it. Les Tremaine and Olin
and
Barbara, of course. And but I did First Nighter before any of them with Don Ameche. And Joan Meredith before that series. But later, when Joanne was producing and directing, I was sort of in the resident company. I was in it every week. For instance, they had Christmas show was a show that we did every Christmas. And I played every part in it over the years except Mary.
And if she had been sick one year, you might have been called.
I might have tried that. I don't know. But it was a great company. That Marvin, of course, was around then and playing in the company, and Harry Elders there was Herb Butterfield, and we were almost together every week. Very unusual that there wasn't a part, some kind of a part in it for all of us.
And you had to, you really put on a show for the studio audience as much as for the listening audience.
Well, in those days in Chicago, if there was a studio audience, it was a dress show. We all kept dinner jackets. I used to have a room, four or five of us actually, over at the Croydon Hotel. And when we get down to any show after 6 o'clock, you always had to dash and get into your dinner jacket. And they had very appreciative audiences all the time in the studio at CBS, WBBM, in the Wrigley Building. And then, of course, the Merchandise Mart had all of the dramatic studios had an audience provision.
The major show, I think, on the major network show on WGN and Mutual was the prestigious Chicago Theater of the Air.
Theater of the Air, yes.
And you must have worked that.
Oh, yes.
A lot,
there again, it was sort of a stock company. Brett Morrison and Bobby Ellison and Fran Carlin and Muriel Bremner. And there were a great many of us that worked that every week. It did the dramatic roles, and of course, Marianne Clare and
Henry Weber
in the orchestra, and Marianne Clare was the soprano, and all of the great tenors from the Met came in, one of them, a different one every week, to do the male singing lead.
We talk about this doing shows in front of a studio audience. Now, did the performers on the radio shows were they apt to sign autographs and things like that for the members of the studio audience?
Yes,
the audience would be following
after the show. They'd catch us on the way out and sign some autographs.
It was very nice to be able to see a radio show because all the listener ever had was his imagination.
That is true. In radio, you built your own sets and created your own characters. And I guess sometimes it was maybe a little bit disappointing for an audience to see what the voice that they had been hearing looked like. Other times they were pleased with what they saw. But the one thing that was the main attraction in every audience show was a sound effect man. Because they just loved to see what he was doing, the clop clop of the coconut shells for the horse's hooves and opening a door and all that sort of thing. You know, all the sound effect equipment was then done live in these days, of course, in later days it was done on record, on tape.
When you hear, often on listening to some of the old radio shows, in a romantic scene, maybe especially in a light comedy, there would be the leading players would embrace and kiss. He would kiss her. And often there would be a little ripple of laughter from the audience because somebody was, kissing the back of their hand? I point out that you're kissing the back of your hand, and not me here.
That's right. Or your lovely wife.
Yeah, those were nice days to doing all of that. Now, you had 40 shows a week, running like mad from 7 in the morning maybe till 10 o'clock at night. Did you ever say, this is ridiculous, going doing all this stuff?
Well,
is it worth it?
You got a little bit jaded sometimes, yes. We used to take what we call a 12-hour vacation. You'd pick a day when you were through fairly early, and evening when you're through fairly early, and didn't have a show until perhaps noon the next day, and you'd imbibe a little heavily. Mm-hmm. And the next morning you were usually a little hungover, but boy, were you relaxed.
It did the trick.
It did the trick.
12-hour getaway.
12-hour getaway, yeah.
Now, from I think it was probably in the middle 40s, and still in Chicago. You were still in Chicago.
Yeah, I left Chicago in 46.
Yeah, you had the lead in a series called Those Websters.
That's right. That's what I came to California with, Those Websters. Uh-huh. We did it for 2 years out here after we came out in 46. Mm-hmm. I played Father Webster, and I'd done that for, I think, 3 years in New York, in Chicago before I get confused between New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago because I've been in all three of them.
Well, you moved from Chicago to Los
to
Angeles,
LA, yeah.
And then later, quite a few years,
20 years later
you went to
New York.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, the Those Websters was a program that replaced another show called That Brewster Boy.
That's right.
Now, I had heard, but I don't know this whole story behind it. I had heard there was some problem with either with the sponsor or with the producers or something on that the Brewster Boy, and they just kind of switched the whole thing around and made it Those Websters.
Yeah, well, it was I don't really know all of the details involved, but it became Those Websters after there was some sort of a uproar in either the writing or production department. I don't know the exact details of that.
But it had a healthy run for about 5 years,
yes,
didn't it?
About 5 years.
And you stayed with it the entire time?
Well, it was like coming out of here with a piece of cake under my arm.
Uh-huh.
Because I came out here and with the show. We did the show one Sunday in Chicago, and the next Sunday out here in Los Angeles. And I didn't have to go around and knock on doors here. I could meet people socially in the business. And they say, what do you do? And I say, well, I play Dad Webster on Those Websters. Well, how would you like to do my show? And I say, I'll be happy to. And so it was a real great entree out here.
Well, what were some of the things that you did out here then once?
Well, the first one that I did was Screen Guild Theater.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then later I did a lot of Lux Theaters. And then I say the Guiding Light, I picked that up out here again after some cessation. And I did a lot of Amos and Andy shows.
Oh, uh-huh.
With Carell and Gosden. And I did Joan Davis's Boss on her show, radio show, for a number of years. And I just sort of went from one deluxe radio theater quite often.
Mm-hmm. The Lux was probably the premier hour-long show on radio as far as the great public was concerned. And that took longer to rehearse than most of the routine half-hour shows, and certainly more than a soap opera.
Oh, yes. Yeah, soap opera was an hour rehearsal and 15-minute show.
Mm-hmm.
No, Lux was practically a whole week's production. I don't know that it was necessary. It certainly wasn't necessary for the radio people, the people that worked in radio all the time, mm-hmm. because we walked one from one show to the other, and with no problem. But some of the picture people were very uncomfortable, and they had to be sort of lulled into a mm-hmm. sense of security.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they had plenty of rehearsal. They didn't stint on rehearsal at all. And over a period of 3 or 4 days is the general rule.
Mm-hmm. You kind of set the pace for appearing in the Great Gildersleeve with your role in those Websters, didn't you? I mean, you became... You got the acknowledgement of your position on the show. You handled the lead, and it was a light comedy. It was, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's true. Well, I hadn't even thought of it that way, but I guess it could be somewhat true. Actually, the strange thing that happened was that Hal Perry, who was playing Gildersleeve, started it on Fibber, and had played it from 1949 till 1950. That was the time that CBS was raiding all of the NBC talent.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hal's agent had signed him to CBS. And then Kraft decided they did not want to change networks, and so it had to recast Gildy, and Hal and I had a voice similarity, and it finally came down to the fact that I felt, and Frank Pittman, who was the producer, felt that I could do it without having to do an imitation, and it worked out very nicely.
It would have been dangerous for someone to imitate Hal Perry. I think you couldn't carry that off.
It was a difficult decision because the producers weren't quite sure whether they wanted to try to keep the voice somewhat the same or whether they wanted a completely
mm-hmm.
different voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure whether I wanted to do it because I took those a career chance, I guess, because if I had failed with it, I'd have been out of my ear, probably. And so we finally did a reading with the writers, and the show was written so well, the character was so well written, that I found that I could play it. As I say, our voice similarity, my voice is a little bit deeper
mm-hmm.
than Hal's, but the quality was there, voice quality was there. And I didn't have to make any conscious effort to do any imitation or anything like that. One rather strange thing that a lot of people don't know, is that the laugh, the Gildersleeve laugh, the hee-hee-hee laugh, mm-hmm. was really Hal's. And he used it as Gildersleeve. When I came into the picture, I decided I didn't want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he used to use that, used to do a character on... called Professor Rollo on a show we did in Chicago called Thank You, Stoogie with Bernadine Flynn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I never did the laugh. I mean, I laughed, but not that laugh. And I used to do what they called the Gildersleeve social chuckle. The
ha ha ha. That's right.
But I didn't do the laugh. Uh-huh. And still, to this day, if somebody, I'm introduced to somebody and they say, oh, you were Gildersleeve? Let me hear you laugh. Because mm-hmm. it was so well ingrained in the character.
Mm-hmm. Did you find it difficult to follow Hal Perry in that role?
No, I didn't, because, as I say, the writing was so beautifully done.
Mm-hmm.
John Elliott and Andy White and Paul West, who were writing the show, wrote it so wonderfully that I just played the character. And... Hal and I had been friends and still continue to be friends. I've seen him through the years a lot, and we get along very well. I think Hal may have been a little resentful at the time, but I don't think he on the long range he was.
We're talking with Willard Waterman, who was, among other characters during the great days of radio, the great Gildersleeve. And we'll be back in just a minute. We're talking with Willard Waterman, who was the great Gildersleeve. He was the Webster in Those Websters. He was, I think, Sheriff Mike Shaw. Did you double Shaw?
That is one of the fallacies in the book that our friend Golden Days of Radio or something.
John Dunning?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was never corrected. It was in there. I never did play Mike Shaw, the Sheriff Shaw. That was played by Leo Curley.
Oh.
And
uh-huh.
Never by anybody else, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. But for some reason or other, it got in the book wrong.
I think Hal Perry said that. I think Hal played Shaw once or twice.
He may have. I don't know. As I say, the only character that I mm-hmm. know for sure that he played was Hod Barrett.
You used to pick up for him occasionally in Chicago, didn't you? When one or the other of you was not able to make a role and it was a continuing thing or something like that?
No, we never replaced each other in a role like that. We played on the same show many times. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when we went in for rehearsal, he and I would get together and say, you want to go high and I'll go low, or you do a dialect and I won't, or something, mm-hmm. so that we got away from the similarity.
Did the general public realize that there was a change of lead actors in The Great Gildersleeve back in that time?
I think many of them did not know.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the things. The billing was different, but in those days people didn't pay all that much attention to billing.
Mm-hmm.
And the voice was had enough similarity that a lot of people for a long time anyway didn't know there was a change. I guess some people still don't know. The name Gildersleeve is bigger than the name Perry or Waterman, and neither one of us have that personal identification.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you have the personal identification with the role of the great Gildersleeve.
Well, a lot of people still say, oh, that was Hal Perry. Mm-hmm. And as I say, we both did it for 9 years. So
yeah. It's amazing that show ran that long. I can't imagine that Hal Perry would have thought in 1949, 1950, when you took it over in 50, didn't
50,
you, at the
yeah.
beginning of that. Did you think that it was going to last for that many more years?
I had no idea at the time how long it would last. I think it was a shame. I think that Hal maybe got a little short shrift from his agent, because they thought they could deliver the show to CBS,
mm-hmm.
and they signed him to the contract. So now he was under contract to CBS, and they had to produce a show for him. So they started a show called Honest Harold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was unfortunate. What they tried to do was pattern the show after the Gildersleeve show. And, of course, Gildersleeve was still on NBC. So it didn't work. And it was too bad, because Hal was a very, very versatile actor. He could do many, many, many voices, many, many things. And it would have been far better for him, I believe, had he developed another character,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and a new show around it, and then that would have been, as the pattern was, gone on to television, and it would have been another new good show, mm-hmm. radio mm-hmm. television show. But with the sort of a copy of the of Gildersleeve, it just didn't work.
You did the Radio Gildersleeve right to the very end of radio. Near the end, I think.
I think we were the last
15-minute shows then, weren't you?
No, we were for 2 years before the end of the era. We did it as a 5-week, 15-minute show,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and it was very, very popular at that time. And then we went back after Crass dropped it. We went back to a half-hour format, and we were, I think, the last audience show in Hollywood.
By that time, you were only doing one show then.
Yes.
You weren't doing two shows, one for the East Coast and one for the West Coast, were you?
No, by that time it was on tape. I mean, we did the East Coast show and the second was on tape. But that took a long time to happen because Kraft had a very adverse feeling about tape. They didn't like tape. And actually, the way we got to taping, under Kraft's supervision anyway, was I had to have an appendectomy. And so I recorded at that time the first scene and the last scene for what was to be the next show. And I did the show one Wednesday, went in Thursday morning to the hospital and had my operation. And in actuality, I could have done the show the next week, but they did this to protect themselves. And then later, when they found out that it didn't change the show any, mm-hmm. why we were able to go to tape.
So the other actors did the show live, but they inserted your records.
Records opening and the record close.
So you were kind of written out of the body of the show.
I stayed home and listened to the show. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
You took the Great Gildersleeve then from radio into television, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did the television series, which only was one season. We did 39 mm-hmm. films, which was mm-hmm. one season. Unfortunately, it didn't. It was not on the network. It was in syndication. And due to some circumstances, it just didn't go beyond the one season. And it probably isn't known, but Hal and I both did an audition for it.
Hmm.
And then they decided I guess, looked more Gildersleeve. I don't know. But when they were trying to decide about going to television, we did, I think, three pilots
mm-hmm.
before it went on the air. But we both had a crack at it anyway.
And he didn't seem to be the type
who well, I don't know.
Created the role.
He created it. But
yeah.
There again, it's one of those things where in radio you could play anything you could sound.
That's right. Well, Leroy, Walter Tetley, couldn't take the role to television.
No, and that's the greatest misfortune in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I think that may have been one of the factors that mitigated against the television series, because that relationship between Gilly and Leroy just wasn't there.
Yeah. You had a young actor, a child actor. Playing.
That was the point. He was an actor.
Yeah.
He seemed to be an actor.
Yeah.
And Walter, you never had any indication he was an actor at all.
How old was Walter Tetley at that time? He had, of course, was a grown man.
Well, he started in Gildersleeve in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, he had been on the NBC Children's Hour.
Well, he worked with Fred Allen in the old Town Hall Tonight in the 30s.
His voice never changed.
Mm.
And I guess he would have been what you want to call one of the little people.
Mm-hmm.
However, his family gave him growth shots when he was younger, mm-hmm. and he grew to I guess he was about 5'6" or 5'7", something like that. Not that tall, 5'4" or 5", something like that. But his voice never changed, and he never had any beard.
But he was so bright. I mean,
nobody read lines like Walter.
Yeah.
He was just, he was just all boy. And Leroy was really the boy down the block. He was great. But unfortunately, he couldn't be used in the television series.
When you were doing Gildersleeve on radio, now you were the lead in a major network series.
Yeah.
Were you also doing other roles on radio?
In the very beginning, I was under contract to Kraft for Gildersleeve
mm-hmm.
exclusively, and I didn't do anything else. But then in later years, after Kraft dropped the show, why I did other things, too. But I did a lot of the other things before I did go to sleep, mm-hmm. between 46 and 50.
When you went into television with Gildersleeve, then Willard Waterman went into television as well. You started doing a number of things.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I had done some before that, but mm-hmm. After the Gildersleeve series, I did other things. I'd done some picture work, motion mm-hmm. picture work, after the time I came out here. I did a film with Crosby in 1947 called Riding High was mm-hmm. the first picture I did. And then I went on to a number of other films.
And then you did some work on the stage as well.
Yeah, that came later. I didn't do a lot of stage. I did a lot of stage work early. Mm-hmm. And when I was here, I would usually go down to La Jolla in the summer and do summer stock down there. And then in 1962, I auditioned for J.B. Bigley and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying out here on the coast. Mm-hmm. And the Cy Fuhrer, the producer, was out here, and I read for him. And then I went back to New York and auditioned again and got the part, and I did that for 2 years in the national company. It was the Rudy Valley part mm-hmm. In How to Succeed in television. And then on the stage, the national company. And then in 1966, I was back in New York doing Succeed out at Paper Mill Playhouse. And I got a chance to audition for Mame, mm-hmm. Babcock and Mame. And I won that audition. And in 1966, I went back and we opened on Broadway with Angela Lansbury and played it for 2 years with her. And then we came out to the coast and did the Civic Light Opera Circuit, San Francisco and Los Angeles. And then I went back into the Broadway company with Janice Page and then Jane Morgan and finally wound up with Ann Miller. Mm-hmm. So I had 4 years of that on Broadway. And I had gone into New York expecting to come back here, of course. But when that ended in 1970, there wasn't all that much going on out here. So I stayed on in New York. Did a revival of Pajama Game, which was a lot of fun. And I did a lot of commercials. And
Which role in Pajama Game? Were you Heinze?
No. I was the boss.
I got a name. Oh, I know. The one who wouldn't give in for the 7.5 cents.
Yeah, that's right. Well, can't say the name.
Yeah. Well, I can't think of it either.
Price of getting old.
You're not getting old, you're getting better.
That's what they say, we hope.
So have you had any musical training or background to be able to appear in these musicals?
Well, actually in Mame I did not have a number, didn't sing. And in Pajama Game I didn't sing. Mm-hmm. But in Succeed I did, I had two numbers. Mm-hmm. And I had taken some voice back in college, actually. And had done a lot of singing in church and
Old Man Hassler.
Hassler, that's right? Yeah, thank you.
I knew it was going to come. come Pajama Game.
You got the memory. Yeah, Hassler. And so I had done a lot of singing, not solo work particularly, but a lot of work, Glee Club, and, mm-hmm. and so I had some semblance of a voice, enough to get by mm-hmm. for musical comedy. Doesn't take a lot of voice. Really.
Well, to do it on Broadway takes a lot of talent, I would say, at any rate. Yeah.
you get by with it. It's all right.
Well, radio, television, movies, the stage, you seem to have done it all. Which do you prefer? Which is, of all of these things?
It's strange. I really prefer stage.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I didn't get involved in it until later, my career, I guess. But the satisfaction of walking on stage and having that live audience out there.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but the fact that you do it every night or eight times a week to a different audience and you get a different reaction. You get a chance to play with a character. And if something doesn't work tonight, well, you do something different so it does work tomorrow night. And you really enjoy it. I did. I enjoy being on stage very much.
And now what are you involved with? What are you doing today?
Well, this past summer, I went back to do a revival of MAME with Angela.
Mm-hmm.
There were six of us from the original cast that did the revival with her. And unfortunately, it didn't work very well. We went into New York in the middle of the summer without any advance and no great publicity campaign. And the people that saw the show loved it and were very happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. But I just don't know what worked or what didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the producer just didn't stick with it long enough. It would have built, I think, and we'd have probably played through the holidays anyway, and maybe into the spring.
It's tough with the economics the way they are to have to stay with it. You know?
That's difficult, there's no question about it.
I always draw the conversation back to the radio days, but, you know, a sponsor and a network, mostly the sponsor, because it was the guy, he was the guy paying the bills, he could afford to commit to 39 weeks of a radio show and say, all right, we're going to go with it for 39 weeks because his expenses were mostly fixed, weren't they?
That's right. They could be predicted.
Yeah.
Now you go into production on dramatic or musical theater. You can estimate what it's going to be, perhaps, and then you find out that the expenses and the increased threefold or fivefold or sevenfold, you know. And so it's hard to know what you're really talking about as far as money is concerned.
So
it's a lot of money, that's all, you know.
Next on the agenda for you?
I don't know.
Got a clean slate and just let things fill in?
I'm available, I guess is what you say.
Uh-huh. You want to work? You want to do some things?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I want to do things. Mm-hmm. I want to do things that I want to do.
Good.
If something comes along that I like, and I'd be very happy to do it.
Well, that's what counts. I want to thank you very much, not only for the chance to sit and chat with you today, but for all of your contributions to the entertainment world, from way back in the early days of Chicago radio with the First Nighter and the Soaps and Tom Mix and into the Great Gildersleeve and all of these other things. You did a wonderful job entertaining the public, and on their behalf, I say thanks to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you very much. It's always a great pleasure to hear that, and it gives you a warm feeling to know that you have been able to entertain people over the years, and I'm thankful for that.
Well,
thank you.
You've made a lasting contribution, and we thank you very much.
It's very nice to know.
Thank you. Thank you, Willard Waterman.